Hello, and welcome to David's Book Talk. Today we have a very special guest. He's a New York Times best-selling author many, many times over. He's one of the best legal thriller writers out there, and I mean one of the best, if not the best. His new book's called Trader of Secrets. It is, if my count's correct, this is number 12 of the Paul Mondrian series?
It is.
Am I saying that name right, Paul Mondrian?
You are.
And his name is Steve Martini, and he's here to talk to us. I always get a kick out of your name, because right away, I see your name. Of course, everybody thinks of the drink when they see your
name. Sure. Ever since I was a kid, I had to deal with that.
Now, you were actually born with the name Martini. It's not It's not a literary name or anything.
It's my dad's name.
Do you really? You are really a terrific legal thriller writer, and I do not say that lightly. I have read many legal thriller writers, and yours are really the only of all the legal thriller writers I have read. I can't speak tonight for some reason. Yours are the best. I don't know what it is about your books. Your plots are always really, really interesting. Your characters are interesting, and I never quite know where your stories are going.
Well, that's good. That's what I work for. I try and create a payoff with a twist at the end. And it's always difficult to do, especially when you've got readers that probe. They see the little hints and the clues, and so it becomes harder and more difficult with each book to try and keep them looking in the wrong direction.
Right. The Trader of Secrets is quite, I mean, when you first start reading it, it seems pretty simple, and then you suddenly realize, wait a minute, this book is getting much, much, much more complex and much more fun. I mean, all of a sudden it just takes off, and it's almost impossible to put down. I mean, literally, I read between Rule of Nine and Trader of Secrets, which I read all weekend, believe it or not, I just couldn't put this book down, and I felt the same way about Rule of Nine. And
well, thank you.
You know, how do you make books, how do you write books that are like that? I mean, what's the trick?
Well, I don't know if there's a trick.
You're doing something wonderful.
The last three books basically were an experiment on my part. I wanted to see if I could continue with my characters and actually draw one other character into the story that I'd sort of left dangling in a standalone book some years ago. And write a trilogy, okay, three books that were connected. And I started with Guardian of Lies, and then The Rule of Nine, and Trader of Secrets. And they all had a common theme, and the theme was basically either weapons of mass destruction. And they had a common thread in terms of a character. The character was a villain, okay? They weren't whodunits, because you knew who did it. It was, the question often was, what were they going to do? Okay, and you tried to mask the exact weapon that they were using and how they were going to deploy it. So it was a little bit of a variation on the theme. All of the earlier books were trial books, courtroom novels, and the question was, who did it? Who was the perpetrator? And so you had to keep the reader looking the other way with regard to the actual perpetrator. So this was a little different in terms of the approach. It was fun to do for that reason. It allowed me also to get away from the first-person acting voice that I had used in so many of the early Mondrian books, where Paul was on stage and you could only see what was happening through his camera's eye. And so I was able in these books to use omniscient point of view whenever Paul wasn't there in scenes. So I was able to use the first-person active voice for Paul, but then slip into a different voice for when you were seeing things from Huerta Liquida, who's the villain, when you see things from his perspective or from the FBI's perspective or any of the other players.
Right.
So it's they were a challenge to write. They weren't easy books to write, but then no book is easy. It's like climbing a mountain every time you start.
And that's what I was thinking while I was reading this Trader of Secrets. I'm like, boy, this book is so complex. I don't know how you can remember all the different plot lines in this book and all the different details and the detailing of it, of all the weapons and all the technology. I assume all this technology in this book is real stuff.
It is.
But you must have an encyclopedic knowledge of all this stuff. I mean,
I did quite a bit of research. The weapon systems, what we don't know is probably the dangerous stuff, because a lot of the stuff is probably national security, behind the veil of national security. But Carl Sagan actually looked at a lot of this stuff back in the early 80s, I guess. And he was, I don't want to give away too much in the interview, but
right.
He was concerned by near-Earth objects and the direction in which we as a species were going to deal with them, and that was we were trying to identify them, okay, those that might impact the Earth. These were naturally occurring events. We knew that in history they had impacted the Earth previously and had been catastrophic in terms of extinction-level events. But what he was particularly about was the manner in which we would deal with them once we identified them as a threat. And he was concerned that any time you have humans dealing with these kinds of things, it not only becomes a defense mechanism, but the question is, will they be harnessed and used for weapons at some point? And he was very concerned that that might be the case. And I won't go into the details, but there seemed to be several schools of thought along those lines. Some believed that there was no real fear here because they would never supplant nuclear weapons because you couldn't time them and use them in that kind of a fashion to form a deterrent. But as you read the book, you start to realize that there are other advantages to using them, and you don't necessarily have to use them as a deterrent, so especially with asymmetrical warfare being what it is. But in any event, it deals across a lot of disciplines, the story does, and it sort of cuts across strategies and theories of national defense, asymmetrical warfare, science, NASA, all of those things. So it was a fun book to write for that reason. I always like to write books when I can learn something myself and then try and treat the reader to some additional knowledge, something new that maybe they haven't been steeped in.
Right. So I thought to myself, well, these are a little different. Maybe I'm not going to like them as much. It turns out I like them the same, if not more, than your other books. And you know, for you, I always seem to trust your writing that it's going to be really good, and it never lets me down. I know I'm not just saying that just because I'm doing this interview. I wouldn't be talking to you if you weren't a good writer. I don't, you know, it's not worth it to me to tell somebody a book's good if I don't really believe it is. I really know that these are great books, and everything you write is great.
Well, what I always hope for is that I hope they have a long shelf life. And the thing that hurts me most sometimes is that publishers, when you leave them, sometimes your backlisted books don't get as much play as they might otherwise to find new readers. So that's what you hope for. You know, we're all not, none of us are going to be here forever. So
right.
you hope that in 100 years people might still be looking at some of these books and reading them and enjoying them.
That's got to feel good to know that your books 50, 100 years from now are still going to be read, that people are still going to be reading them. And now, has Harper released your backlist at all?
Well, Harper only has four books.
Okay.
The others are with Putnam. So
right. They own the rights to them.
Putnam. And they own the rights. And they hold them. Obviously, they're not going to allow them to go out of print because then they revert to me and I can sell them again. But the question is whether how many of them are in print, you know, in terms of the backlisted books. And moreover, with what's happening now, how many of them are in e-print version? Because that's really where people will find backlisted materials in the future.
Right.
Are you know, the e-books.
Right.
So we hope for that. Yeah.
Right. Now, you had a couple books that were The List, and what was the other one that weren't
Critical
part of
Mass.
The series?
Actually, Critical Mass was the book that set the stage for the three books in the trilogy. Critical Mass was written before 9/11.
Yes.
It dealt with basically a potential nuclear event. I won't go into too much detail on it, but it created some. It was outside the series, and it created a character, Jocelyn Cole, a woman, a female character, who comes into this trilogy. She comes in the second book.
I didn't realize she was in Critical Mass.
Yeah, she was. That's where she was born. That's the story of Jocelyn Cole is the story of Critical Mass. She's the protagonist in Critical Mass.
And you know what's great about your books too? We never really know who we can trust. I mean, until I get to the very end, I'm not even sure who we can trust. And you never, anybody could be a double agent. Anybody. And we that's half the fun is reading these and trying to figure out who is and who isn't.
That's it.
And who's working on what side. But the relationship between Paul Mondriani and his cohorts, I use the word cohorts, Herman, I get them mixed up for some reason. The names, because they're so close.
They're similar, yeah.
And they're such great characters. I mean, and of course, Herman goes through a lot in these two books. And Harry's just so, he's just like Harry. I mean, he's just, they're all interesting characters, and you never quite know. And a lot of times it's a relationship between Paul and these characters that makes it so much fun. Between Paul and Jocelyn in this one,
yeah.
and Paul and Harry and all the others, too.
Yeah. Well, yeah, Harry goes back to the original book that launched the series, and that was Compelling Evidence. That was the first book in the series.
Which is one of the all-time great mysteries. I love that book.
It had a lot of humor in it. I think that's what made that book so good. I spent a long time crafting that book. It took me about 4 years to actually write. So and time does add to the value of a good novel.
Right.
The time that an author takes in crafting it, because really it's not in the writing, it's in the rewriting. The value is pumped into a story.
Yeah, I think people think that, oh, you just sit down and you write the book and it's done, but it never works like that.
No, it never does. And I know for me, I'd never release a book. It would never be published because I'd always be rewriting it. There are on some occasions I'll go back and I'll look at one of my backlisted books and I'll go, boy, I wish I could have that back for a few months, you know, and sit down and rewrite.
And that's what amazes me. When you were with Putnam, it seemed like it was taking longer for your books to come out. Now they're pretty regular once a year.
They are.
You must be working twice as hard.
Well, I am. My life has changed a lot in the last few years, and I'm getting long in the tooth. I turned 65 in February. I turned 65.
But you sound really young. I mean, you just have this young-sounding voice.
I still have a lot of enthusiasm for what I do, and I'm not going to stop writing. But I may do some books outside the series. I'm not sure yet. I'm looking at a line of stories, and the question is whether I want to do them as period pieces and set them back in time about 50 years, or whether I want to do them as modern-day stories with a backdrop of history in terms of dealing with them. If I do the latter, then Paul and his coterie of friends and supporters would be fine for the story. If not, I'll probably craft something outside the series.
So we've definitely not seen the last of Paul by a long shot.
Yeah, no, we have not.
Because that's what really sells with your books. Paul is a huge draw for you.
It is, and that's what the publishers want. That's why they like the series books. It's like going back to old friends. The publishers basically only want a contract for those books. Although they have, my current publisher has allowed, they've talked openly about the possibility of my being able to write a book or two outside the series. So it's a possibility I may go there.
Oh, that's pretty cool.
Yeah.
And the thing is, you say you do a lot of research, and you have, now that you do the research on all these books, your readers are going to expect that every time now. So that's a lot of pressure to put on you.
Well, that's part of the problem. It's like the second book syndrome. You know, if you write a big bestseller on your first book, it's a daunting experience to have to follow it up with a second book. Most novices who start writing novels think they can write one novel and retire. Some have done that, but usually a publisher wants more than that. You know, they want to have you on a multi-book contract if you can write, especially if you can write on a.
Well, are you only happy when you're writing? Can you ever imagine retiring?
It's a possibility, but I don't think I'll ever. I think unless I got sick and lost my health, I would continue to write. I don't think I could ever get away from it forever, for a long time.
Right.
I did take a 2.5-year sabbatical. And I did some traveling a few years back when I left Putnam and went over to William Morrow.
Right.
I took 2.5 years off, and I didn't write. And that was a tumultuous time both for me personally as well as within the book trade. That was about the time the economy started to slide over the abyss. There were a lot of changes within publishing. The e-books were starting to come out. And I lost some of my readership at that point. Never quite come back, I think, because of what happened in 2008 with the economy.
But you're a great writer. I think people are going to find their way back to you. I mean, I certainly have. I never left you. And I'm really, I get excited with each book that I read of yours. And, I got behind it when I didn't read Rule of Nine. I didn't finish it. And then I realized, this is like a three-book series. I got to read both of them before I even interview you, which I was determined to do and did. I found myself immensely just enjoying both books.
Well, wonderful.
I mean, these are great books.
That really is the payoff. When you hear that from readers or when you get an email or something on one of your websites explaining how much the reader has enjoyed these books, it really is. That's almost more than any compensation that a publisher can give.
Right. Yeah. And his daughter, who plays a big part in these books, which is interesting. I mean, she's almost as a big a part of the book as Paul is.
Yeah, in this last book particularly, and I've tried to create or make Paul age, although you don't actually see it, but you sense it. I wanted him to age in a very real way, so his daughter grows up. I mean, the first time you see her, she's very young. She's a child in elementary school, and when you see her now, she's graduated from college. She's an adult. She has her own life, and she wants to have that life, and the life's been taken from her, basically, by the events surrounding Paul.
Right.
She's in jeopardy as a consequence.
And that's another thing that you really sense in this book, the danger that's involved. The fact that any of these characters could be killed at any moment.
Right.
That's the realism, I mean, and how real that you as an author can make it seem. And when you're reading these books, you really start to feel afraid for her and even for Paul and Harry and Herman. You start, you know, to wonder, you know, anything could happen. And I wonder what's going to happen. And you're not sure some of them are going to make it.
Yeah. No, it's a tough one. You know, it's and I think my editor was actually concerned at one point that I might kill one of the principal characters off. And I told him. I didn't tell him anything. I told him to wait and see.
Right.
What would happen. You never want to commit yourself to anything because you never know. Books like this, you can have an outline. It can be very detailed and very structured, but sometimes you deviate from it. Sometimes you feel a need to deviate from it. So I never like to hem myself in with any promises at an early stage in a book because too many times the book has taken a turn that was absolutely necessary. It's such a free-flowing exercise in terms of creating a story that you have to be willing to go with the flow sometimes, and it becomes almost compulsory. So I didn't commit to anything, but I was loath to get rid of any of the principal characters.
Well, that's the deal. I mean, when Patricia Cornwell got killed off Benton Wesley, look at the backlash that was involved with it. I mean, she had so many people upset about that. I mean, even I was upset about it.
Uh-huh, yeah.
And, you know, you have to think really hard. Do I kill this person off? But then James Patterson killed one of his main characters off, and I thought, wow, if he can do it, anybody can do it, you know. And it's in a way, it's kind of good because then you kind of wonder, well, maybe it's going to happen. And Karen Slaughter did the same thing she killed off one of her really, really likable characters.
Well, the trick was devised by Conan Doyle. If you kill them, make sure that the reader doesn't actually see the blood on the ground when it's over.
Right.
You don't want to see that smashed head or that broken spine.
You're good at writing scenes with blood too. That's one thing I enjoy. You're very descriptive about the blood, so we really get an idea what it really. I mean, you can almost feel that stiletto going through somebody.
I will tell you something. We had an exercise at one point a few years ago where, and I won't tell you who launched this exercise, but we were invited to, you know, a number of best-selling authors were invited to write a chapter, a piece of a book.
Right.
And it was a spite game because, I wrote after James Patterson. I had the chapter right after his. And what happened was I got the book about halfway through, okay, and there was no – they gave some general overview of where we could go with the story, but there were no fast rules as to what you could and couldn't do.
Okay? Right.
Well, obviously, they peopled the book with characters, and then promptly – a number of writers started killing the characters off. So by the time it got to me, there was almost nobody left walking in the story.
Wow.
So I had to go back, basically, and find a character that had been killed, but had been killed sort of outside the camera's view, okay? It wasn't that you were told that he was killed. You saw him be killed, but he actually fell from a helicopter at some considerable height over water, okay? So the question was, could he have survived the fall? And sure enough, he did, came back. So I was able to use that character, basically, to craft my scene, but it was like a chess game, and it was a fabulous exercise. I learned more in actually writing that exercise and doing that project than I had in many cases. And what happened was I did that shortly before I started the trilogy, and it opened my eyes to the possibilities of what I could do with these characters. And I will credit that exercise in large part with this trilogy.
And that's another thing I love about your books. I never know what's coming with the next book. I never know where you're going next. And, you know, some authors write the same kinds of books each time. You know what to expect each time, but I never know where to expect you're going to go next. I mean, and how many legal thriller writers are there? You know, there's just tons and tons and tons.
There's a lot.
And everything's been told, really. I mean, how do you come up with
all the good titles have been used.
Right. But you somehow get a great book every time you write, and you know how difficult that is. You and John Sanford seem to have the biggest knacks I've ever seen of authors that are able to do that. And
I appreciate that. Sanford's one of my heroes.
I mean, it's this ability that you have that a reader can open any one of your books and just enjoy it. And there's nothing boring in any of your books either. Now, I admit, Trader's Secrets in the very beginning, I thought, oh, I'm not sure where I like where this is going. And then all of a sudden, it's like, oh, now I do. You know, all of a sudden you start to realize, well, he was just taking time to tell the story. And you have to give an author that time. Sometimes...
Well, I had to. If you hadn't read the previous book, you wouldn't have known what was starting. And I had to... Are you talking about the very opening of the book?
Of Traitor's Secrets, yeah. Like the first... I was fine, and then I think it was like page 110 or 114, somewhere in there.
Okay.
It got, I thought, this is a little bit slow. I need something to happen. Before I knew it, I'm on page 140 and then 200, and then it's just taking off. And I don't remember what page it took off on, but it wasn't very long after, like page 130 or 140, somewhere in there. It's one of those things where the reader's like, well, am I going to enjoy this? And then... Here it is, then it's 3 o'clock in the morning, and I've read everything, and I'm feeling this, wow, that was really terrific. I wish there were another one of his to read.
Great.
And, you know, and that...
That's the problem. You can't write fast enough.
And the readers just can't get enough. That's the problem. I mean, they come in and they say, when's his next book coming out?
Yeah.
Or we even had a customer come in the other, this was like a week or two ago, and they said to me, what's going to happen with Ted Bell's books? He just died. Well, Ted Bell didn't die. And you get these, the customers don't really, they think they know things and they don't. I mean, and I talked to the buyer and they said, he's not dead. And he wasn't, it turned out he wasn't dead. He's very much alive apparently, but it freaked me out. I mean, it's like.
He's just a little slow getting his next book out and rumors started. Who knows?
I mean, and it turned out there was somebody named Ted Bell that died, but it wasn't him. And it was like, wow. But I mean, all it takes is one little rumor and everything starts.
Sure.
But I wonder when you sit down to write a book like Traitor's Secrets. Of course, this was being a trilogy. You knew about what you wanted to write in the third book, right?
Yes, I did.
So you knew where you were going. So it wasn't like you were working with a blank slate, but you had an idea of where you wanted the story to go.
I had a general overview or an outline of all three books, so I knew generally what I was going to deal with. I knew basically what the weapon system would be. I didn't know all the twists and turns in the story. I knew some of the general locations and had been to most of them. So the book went from there, the story went from there.
I like the relationship between his daughter and what was his name, Aiden, was it?
Yes, Aiden.
I like that relationship between the two of them is really classic. Now we can't discuss more about it.
Sure.
Because it will give something away if we do. But there are certain characters of yours that when they interact are really interesting to read.
Well, thank you.
And you do that really well. And not all authors can do that. Sometimes you, actually, I was talking to a Penguin author tonight, and you know, sometimes you know you don't want to write a book where it says he said, she said, and go back and forth like that because it gets so boring after a while. You have to find a way to make the story interesting, to make the story believable, to throw some action in there, to throw some surprises, and to have a lot of suspense. And you seem to do that really, really well. How difficult is that really to do?
You know, I think it comes from developing over a period of years an ear for what you write. You've got to have a critical ear, and then the ability to go back and change dialogue, alter dialogue, add things. If you can't sense when something's dying on the page, you're going to be in trouble because you're going to write stuff that readers are going to hate. They're going to close the book and go on to something else.
Mm-hmm.
Especially now. I mean, there's so many opportunities for other leisure activities or other books. So.
So you don't feel that pressure to constantly be this way?
Oh, you do. No, you've got to maintain that critical ear. And oftentimes I'll read material out loud to myself, okay? For some reason, if I hear it audibly, it's different than just reading it in your head silently. And I'll say that doesn't work. And you just have to be prepared to throw it out and start over again. Sometimes it'll take you in an entirely different direction. But coming up with a dog, for example, coming up with Aiden's response to the dog and how the dog responded to him.
Right.
It tells you a lot about an individual. It's those kinds of things that develop character, and you start to. It's much better than using narrative to talk about the character and what he did in his background. You've got to show it. So it's all about the basics of writing. It's about the basic tenets of the craft.
And that, you see, that's a point too. Some writers like to have it in the background. They'll say, well, this happened or this happened. They won't even explain how it happened, and you feel cheated. You feel like you weren't there when you're the when you're the reader, and you don't get to feel that. Then you go, oh, well, that's not fair. I want to see how that came to be.
Yeah, it's the difference in hearing about something and seeing something with your own eyes. And therein lies the difference. That's the real value of showing in a novel.
I did want to ask you, have you been to all these places in Traders of Secrets?
Been to most of them, okay. I've not been to the Arab Emirates, but...
Will you ever get there?
I don't know. I may get there at some point. But actually, it's fairly easy to go through the area because I travel to Asia quite a bit.
All
right. I just go the other way. And I go to Thailand quite often. And so going to Thailand, you can go through the Arab Emirates and fly Emirate Air, I believe it is.
Now, the relationship between Paul and his daughter is quite unique. Now, do you have a daughter that you have a relationship like that?
I do, and she's just Sarah's age. So that's where the thread of that came from. Yes, my daughter finished college. She's working for a small film company at this time, yeah.
That's great. I mean, it shows in your writing, because you can tell something. There's been some research done here. This isn't just a... It's very hard to write different characters. It's hard as a reader when you read a book that each voice has to be different. And when I say voice, each character has to seem different from another character. They can't seem too much alike or it ruins the book.
Right.
And you do that very well. I don't know. I think you were just born to be a writer because you just have a knack for the different voices. Now, I'm not saying it's not difficult. I'm sure you have a terrible time with it sometimes.
Yeah, it's very hard sometimes, especially in the early going in a novel. It's unnerving.
But does your...
It never gets any easier.
Does your editor have a sense of that, too, or is it all you that fixes it? Or does sometimes your editor say, well, this voice doesn't sound right to this?
No. My editing has been, all the way through my career, has been fairly light. They'll question a few things, sometimes technical stuff. Most of the editing is on the copy editing side. You know, occasionally I'll make a mistake with a basketball team and put them in the wrong city or something, and then find out, if you don't follow sports that closely, that team left that city 3 years ago. You know, and so you go back and you fix that. But you know, most of the editing doesn't deal with voice, doesn't deal with characterizations. Those things are once in a while they'll raise questions about, you know, this doesn't ring true, but it's very, very rare. I think I've only had maybe all of the 15 books I've written.
Well, there's a question I want to ask, and I'm not sure I should ask it because I might give something away, but did Paul and his practice, and I love it, in the middle of the book, all of a sudden we realize, wait a minute, his practice is really suffering. Is it ever going to get back to the way it is? Now, you obviously know the answer to that question, but I don't know whether we should talk too much about that and give anything
away. I'm sure I do know the answer to that question. The question of whether he's ever going to go back to the courtroom, okay? I don't know.
Well, what else would he do? I guess that's the question.
Well, it depends what happens with he and Jocelyn, okay? What Jocelyn does with the rest of her life, I'm not sure, okay? The stories that I'm looking at writing next deal with nostalgic aspects of Hollywood, okay?
Huh.
And
Harper likes that idea?
Well, I don't know that they do because I haven't shared it with them yet.
Uh-oh. I hope they're not listening.
They could be crafted in current murder mysteries or current murder stories, homicides, okay? A string of homicides, basically.
So does this mean you're going to visit Hollywood sometime soon?
I have already done that.
Okay. Ah.
I went to one of the movie studios and did a fairly detailed tour about a year and a half ago. And so this idea has been with me for some time now. Some people like it. Some people don't. It deals with the golden age of Hollywood, when many of the films were made on the studios themselves, either in sound stages or on the lot, okay, which isn't happening now. These things are basically either tourist attractions where people go for tours to find out what it was like in the old days. They're used mostly for television productions at this point, and most feature films are shot on location overseas, or in this country, but on location. And so that's the backdrop for it. But I'm the stage I would be setting would be using a lot of the old classic films, Casablanca, some of the old noir mysteries, okay,
mm-hmm.
Film noir. And I don't want to say anything more about the concept, okay?
So do you already have the title of your next book in mind?
I don't. I don't have a title. Titles are very difficult. In fact, that's probably one of the weak areas for me. Now, the titles of these books with William Morrow, and actually one of the things I've been most happy with are the titles,
mm-hmm.
because they've assisted me on that. That's been a huge help. And the cover designs. They've done magnificent cover designs, I feel.
But the interesting thing is, I'm still not sure I understand what rule of nine actually means. Now, you probably can't tell me because it'll give something away, but I'm still not sure why it was called rule of nine, even though I know about...
The book?
Yeah, oh yeah.
Oh, well then let me tell you. Rule of nine, basically, you have nine Supreme Court justices, and the question is, what's the most powerful branch of the federal government? Okay, if you were going to destroy one branch of the federal government, which one would have the greatest impact?
Oh, I see.
No question about it. It's the Supreme Court.
Oh, I see.
If you assassinate a president, you have a vice president. Nothing really changes. If you were to take out the entire Congress, they'd have an election within a very brief period of time, and you'd be back right where you started with new members of Congress. But largely, the politics would remain the same. But if you took out the Supreme Court, okay, you'd have the President of the United States able to name all nine justices at one time. Okay, he could pack the court, all right?
Right.
And that sway, that political sway, would last probably for 40 or 50 years. Maybe
I saw that connection, but the title, for some reason, wouldn't connect with the title. Now that you make it sound like,
yeah,
oh, Bill, I should have realized that.
Yeah, there's nine justices, and so that's the issue. The issue is if you really wanted to change the direction of politics in the United States, that would be the institution to change. Okay? So if you could pick the institution of the three branches of government, that would be the one that would have the most lasting impact and probably the most radical impact.
What percentage of your time, the time you devote to things, would you say is devoted to writing? Total time. I mean, take a 24-hour day. What percentage of the time are you writing?
Well, I tend to do my research early on, obviously. I don't do research generally as I write. That's usually, my research is done, it's in a binder, okay? Much of it is in my head, but if I need to get the specific details, I'll go to the binder.
Does that get harder as you get older, remembering things?
Oh, sure.
So do you find yourself writing things down more?
Yeah, you're holding a lot of threads in your hand all at one time and trying to make sure they're woven in the proper...
You must have an iPad or an iPod or one of those things.
No, I don't, actually. I use pen and paper for that kind of thing.
Really?
I have computer generated printouts and downloads, okay, that are in the binder, and they're all itemized basically by index tabs.
Wow.
But the writing, the actual physical writing of the manuscript, is usually done in about 4 months at the end of the 12-month cycle. And that's a very intense time. There will be times when I'll be writing, I hate to tell you this, 20 hours a day. Okay, I'll get 4 hours sleep.
20 hours a day?
20 hours. I have at times sat at the computer and not gotten out of the chair for 20 hours.
But look what comes as a result, though. Look at the really intense, really great books that come out of that, which is wonderful. But my gosh, do you get even 4 hours of sleep then?
It's hard, especially as you get older. It takes a toll on you. There are times when I get so involved in the book that I will go through and I won't eat. I'll sit for 20 hours. I won't get out of the chair. And all of a sudden, I look up and realize it's 5 o'clock in the morning, and I've been at this since
since
7 or 8 o'clock the previous day. You know, maybe not 8 o'clock.
Well, don't you get to the point where you just burn yourself out?
You can, yeah, and that's the problem. The problem is you can start having a physical failure. Writing a book that's involved like this over a 12-month cycle takes a lot out of you, especially as you get older.
So, right. But would you prefer to write a book every other year?
When I first started writing, I was on an 18-month cycle, and for me, that was almost perfect, okay,
mm-hmm.
at that time in my life. But back then, I started writing when I was 40, okay? And back then, I had more stamina than I do now.
Right. Well, you've built a solid bestseller. I mean, a lot of your books, I think, have most of your books been bestsellers?
They've all been on the bestsellers list, with the exception of the very first book.
So, playing devil's advocate, you could retire tomorrow.
Oh, I have enough money to retire. In fact, I haven't taken any advances on any of the last four books. I refuse to take any advances, signing advances. So I take money only as the manuscript is completed and is deemed acceptable by the publisher.
Is that right? Well, that's unusual.
Then I will take half payment at that time and then a quarter payment upon part cover pub and a quarter upon paperback. So it's the way I function.
I've never heard of that before.
Well, I wanted to do it. I learned some things as a lawyer I didn't like, okay? I was late on a book with Putnam.
Right.
Canceled the contract on me, okay?
Oh.
And I learned that under the IRS rules, Internal Revenue, if you take it money, signing money, okay, and then you pay your quarterly advances, your quarterly estimates on taxes, if you end up having to pay that money back to the publisher because they've canceled the book because you're late on delivery, something happens, you're sick, whatever, you don't get your tax money back, okay? IRS keeps that money, all right, even though you never earned it, and you have to refund it to the publisher. It's the way the IRS rules are written, so it's very unfair.
And that's legal?
Oh, yeah. Those are the tax laws. They get to write the law any way they like, and that's what Congress wrote. So you don't.
Well, if you didn't earn the money, then how can they tax you for it? That's stupid.
No, they just do. You had to advance the money to IRS because you have to pay quarterly estimates, okay? And you can't get that money back. Now, you can probably write it off on if you lose money, you know,
right,
or losses, but they treat that money as theirs, and they do not have to refund it to you. So
you could retire tomorrow. Aren't there other things you'd like? Wouldn't you like? Don't you sometimes wake up in the morning and say, "I'm just going to retire, and it's too much work, and I just can't do it."
And I love to travel. I love to go see other places and experience new cultures.
But I can't imagine not being able to read a book by you. If you told me, if you woke up tomorrow and called me and said, "David, I'm never going to write a book again," I would be very sad.
Well, I appreciate that.
And as would a lot of your readers, I'm sure.
But we'll wait and see what happens.
I'm not worried you're going to do that. I'm just saying you could do that. But yet you put yourself through the torture. And I say torture in a fun way. But it is a lot of work to do this book, to write.
The anxiety level when you're facing a deadline 4 months away is severe, let me tell you.
Does it ever get stressful to your heart? Do you ever get sick as a result?
Yes. Okay. I mean, you can get physically ill. Okay.
You're being very honest with me. I'm amazed at the things you're saying to me.
And it's very difficult sometimes to do this. It's not, you know, people have I think we all often have a very narrow or shallow view of what's involved in many occupations and professions.
Right.
Many people think all lawyers are rich. That's not true. Most lawyers struggle with a solo practice with their hand to mouth, okay? There's a tremendous amount of stress in practicing law. Most lawyers would much rather be doing something else, but they've trained to do this, and they're not equipped to do other things, and so they have to do what they have to do, you know. So they did a survey of California lawyers at one time, and 70% of them said they'd rather be doing something else. So, and I think that's probably gone up to 80% by now.
Right.
Very acrimonious undertaking.
But what are the rewards that you get? Obviously, there's a reason you're doing this.
I think the reward is seeing the word crafted on the page. I've always gotten a big bang out of being able to write something, if it involves humor or pathos or whatever, and say I did that. Those are my words. Okay, so it's like an artist painting a picture or someone crafting a sculpture. You know, you get to look at the finished product and say that's mine. I created that. Okay. Now, if you don't get a kick out of doing that, then you shouldn't be writing.
Right.
That's really the payoff that you get. Now, to be paid well for doing it is very, very nice.
Now, do you think there's more people that feel like you do, or more people that just write to make money?
It's hard to say. I think there's a mix of two. But I don't think I've ever really met a writer who's been able to stick it out, who didn't enjoy the process of crafting the story. Okay. I think you have to enjoy that. If you see it as mere drudgery and you never get that pleasure out of it, I don't think you could do more than one book. Okay? I think you'd write your one opus and that would be it. And there have been a few writers that have done that, you know, famous writers who have done that.
Do you think you think you're a better writer than you are a speaker?
Oh yes, no question. Yeah. I'm also a better writer than I ever was a lawyer, and I know that.
Okay. Well, how long were you a lawyer?
17 years. So.
Did you ever enjoy it?
Not really. There were times when it was okay. The times that I enjoyed it was when I was writing briefs in the federal court, okay? But again, it involved writing. It involved reasoning. It involved argument. It involved trying to persuade a court of a certain position. And I was crafting words, you know? So it's always involved the ability to put words on paper that has, to me, delivered the greatest reward.
Right, and look at the rewards you bring us, and with the stories that you tell. I mean, they're just so good.
Well, I appreciate that. I mean, that's a huge payoff psychically.
Right.
But
there are writers that know what they're doing and do it great, and others that are good but aren't great, and then there are some that are just telling the same stories over and over again. And then, I mean, it's all different. I was just discussing this with somebody tonight about how series can get old. Your series never gets old. It has never gotten old. You and John Sanford, I almost forgot his name. You and John Sanford both have this knack to be able to tell a different story with each book and make it interesting. And it never gets to the point where, oh, this is all the same over and over and over again. It never seems that way with, and I'm not, and it isn't that way. It's not only it seems that way, it is never dull. Your books are never to the point where I'm sick of the characters, I'm sick of the same old things, because there's always something different happening. But that's very, very hard to do.
It is.
I think even Robert Parker, who a lot of people respected, I mean, to a certain extent, the Spencers got, after 30 books, you know, what do you do? How do you make each one new? I mean,
we'll find out if I do another 15, if I can. I mean, 30 books is a lot of material, okay?
Right.
And I wouldn't begrudge someone if the stories started sounding alike. You're going to run out of material at some point. You know, even with a hard-boiled PI, even with a lawyer, it doesn't matter who your character is. At some point, the writer is going to get stale. And part of the way you refresh yourself is by stepping away from the series and writing a standalone novel involving other characters. Now, it may be a lawyer, okay, but it may be a female lawyer. It may be somebody other than Paul Mondrian who has a different background.
Right.
Okay.
Would you ever write a female lawyer?
I have. Two of my standalone books involve female protagonists.
You know, I have to admit, I haven't read the standalones. I don't think I only read.
One was only the series. Yeah, one was Critical Mass.
Right.
Great book, and the other was The List, which you really should read.
Right.
The List was about publishing. It's about book publishing.
You know what? I don't know why, but I never did. I always meant to sit down and read it, and I never did. And
that's the book my publisher hated, and she didn't want to publish it because it had some very nakedly nasty things to say about commercial publishing.
Oh, I see.
It created a sandbox where.
Do you think they thought you were biting the hand that feeds you?
Oh, sure they were. Yeah, sure they did. My publisher was very unhappy with that book, and I said, hey, I'm just, you know, it's a novel, it's fiction. You know, you write about lawyers, you write about other people, and you always say, hey, don't worry, it's only fiction. Well, this is only fiction.
Well, so you're writing these books, you're having a good time writing, obviously, and you love doing the research, and you still get to travel. What are you missing out on? If you retire tomorrow, what are you missing out on now that you could do if you did retire?
Well, I would have more time to travel and just relax and enjoy myself, okay? What happened is, and I this is probably, I should go off the record and I'll talk to you when we're finished.
Right.
About my potential future. They've offered me contracts, and I've indicated that I really don't want to sign any more contracts right now. What I really want to do is write the next book without a contract. So that I take some of the pressure off of me in terms of deadlines.
You're certainly different than from any other author I've talked to. You don't hear an author say that very often. Authors are just happy to get a contract.
Oh, sure they are. And I can understand that. If I would have been the same way 20 years ago, especially in this market. I don't have to worry financially at this point. Okay, I've been fairly frugal.
Right.
I didn't overextend myself. My house is paid for. I drive a car that's 11 years old.
Right.
25,000 miles on it. And I don't even take it out of the garage often because I ride a motorbike for transportation at this point. And it uses very little gas. And when I'm in Thailand, I use nothing but motorbikes.
I think that's the one thing that I wish when I wake up in the morning that I never had to worry about money ever again. I mean, I think it's a dream for everybody. And it's not just that I want to be rich. I mean, I guess there's a part of me that would love that feeling. But the feeling that you never have to worry about bills.
Yeah, it's the sense of independence. I'm not sure I'm in the boat where I never have to worry about money again. I think we all have to worry about money to get money again, except for the billionaires, okay? And the reason I say that is I think that things are so precarious at this point.
Right.
In terms of the world economy, that I could wake up tomorrow and find out I'm broke just along with everyone else. We'll all be in the soup line together. But that's the way the world is, you know. If it happens, it happens. There's nothing we can do about it. But in terms of my own, what I can do to affect my future, it's done, okay? I have my retirement set aside. I don't intend to touch it until I'm forced to by the federal government at 70 and a half. I don't need to touch it until then.
Right.
And I fed my corporation, and it'll feed me now until I reach that point. And if I do more books, at this point, I've followed a very rigid plan for my future, and I don't need anything more. If I do anything more, it actually increases my exposure to taxation, but I don't mind that. And it'll take care of some other people who work with me. I have an assistant who has been with me many years, and I want to keep her employed as long as I possibly can.
Right.
My daughter will probably inherit whatever I have at some point.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah.
Which will make you happy.
It will. So I'll be pleased. And so what I write from here on out will be for my pleasure. And what I receive for it in terms of compensation.
What about, do you think about your readers, or do you think, well, I would hate to not give them a book every year?
I do. If
I don't see a book by you next year, I'll be very disappointed.
I understand. By 65, I'm 65 years of age at this point. You also want to have some time for yourself. Okay?
Absolutely, and I think you should.
Yeah, and so I probably, whether I'll have another book at this time next year is, I don't know. I can't tell. I can't tell you right now. Whether I'll have another book shortly after that, I think I'm pretty certain that I will, God willing, if I can maintain my health at all. I'm not going to quit.
Now, your books with Harper are still making the bestseller list, though, too, right?
They did, yeah. They hit the best. The last one hit the bestsellers list in paper. It's getting harder and harder to hit that list because there's so much competition out there. And the list has been destabilized to some extent by the e-publications.
Right.
They are counting the e-sales, but I don't know how they're weighting them, okay? No one seems to know. And the only list anyone ever pays attention to, it seems, is the New York Times list within the publishing industry.
Right.
So how the New York Times is weighting the Times used to weight their sales figures more based upon independent sales, independent bookstores.
Right.
So many of those have closed down. They've been hit hard by the recession.
Right.
A number of the bookstores that I used to go to sign books along the corridor here in between Bellingham, where I live, and Washington and Seattle, are gone. They've just went there.
And it's hard for you to travel. I mean, I've never seen you on the East Coast. I'm on the East Coast and working.
I'm going to be in Miami 2 days from now.
Are you really?
Yeah, I'll be in Coral Gables.
Good for you.
And I'll be in Iowa the following week.
So you love to travel. I mean,
I do. Yeah, I do. I'll go wherever they tell me to go. Okay, and I've told them that. And for the most part, most of my tours have been on the West Coast. Okay. I've done a few. I've taken a few trips, and I'll be back at Thriller Fest in July.
You're amazing. I mean, you say you're 65, but you sound like you have the energy of a 40-year-old man.
I have a lot of energy, but we all develop health problems as we get older.
Right.
So my doctors are telling me to watch the stress.
Well, on your book, I must admit, on the back of your book, you look a little tired. You do look tired, but now I know why, because you've been working so hard on these books.
Well, that's it.
I don't know how old this picture is, though.
The picture is about 2 years old, 3 years old.
2 years?
But yeah, I don't look like I'm 40 anymore.
You don't look like you like having your picture taken either.
Actually, that photographer did some, he was one of the best photographers I've ever seen. He took two of the best pictures, but unfortunately the publisher didn't want to use them. I was smiling too much, okay? And they wanted something that looked stern and sinister.
Are you serious?
A shadowed face that had a little bit of a stern look on it with some wrinkles. So that's the one they used, with the water in the background.
I'm amazed that at all the years I've been reading your books, I've never gotten a signed book from you, and I should have at some point, because I've never been in the same vicinity you've ever been in.
You can box them up, and I'll send them back to you. Send them to my address, and I'll give you that one.
Oh, that'd be great. I that would be a thrill for me, because I've never had one, and I'd like to get at least one from every author, but it's very difficult.
And whatever you want signed, and I'll be happy to sign and send them back, or I'll send you book plates.
Right. That would be great. We'll work something out, I'm sure of it. So, can we assume that there will be a couple more Paul Mondrianis, do you think?
I think you can probably look forward to that, assuming I have the longevity to do that, yeah.
I mean, there's never any certainty in life. I know that,
right.
But I mean, your plan is to do at least a couple more.
Yeah, I would hope to do at least two more, maybe more than that. I have no specific intentions to retire from writing permanently. Let's put it that way.
Right.
Okay. Yeah.
I think to a certain extent that's good, because there's that fear of what's it going to be like if I do stop writing? Am I going to be bored? Am I going to be? Of course, you can always go back to it. But
you can. That's the point.
I mean, Stephen King was going to retire. How long ago was that?
Yeah, well, he was going to retire because he'd had that bad accident, and he was in so much pain. He's probably come back from that. And so you suffer the pain. You're going to suffer the pain whether you're sitting around, doing nothing, or whether you're sitting around writing.
Now he's writing a book on JFK. I mean, what it would be like to go back and change the JFK assassination.
Yeah.
Which is a great idea.
Sure, sure.
How writers come up with these incredible ideas. I mean, I'm always looking at the books that are coming out. I'm always curious to see what writers are going to tackle next. And when I see the book and what they're about, it's got to catch your eye too. You think you can't just write, or it can't just be a book. It's got to be an interesting book. It's got to be something that hasn't been done a lot. You don't want to do the same things over and over again.
Let me make a prediction. I'm going to predict that what you have is you have the baby boomers. I'm the first year of the baby boom. I think you're going to have an increasing amount of nostalgia. Okay, you're going to have people going back and writing about things that occurred in the 50s and 60s.
Right.
When they were children. In some cases, you might even go back as far as the 40s, because they'll write about what their parents told them happened in the 40s.
Right.
Okay? Those family tales that we all hear around the kitchen table.
Right.
When we were kids. Okay. That spawned my first book. That's what got me writing initially. It was a tale that was told to me around the kitchen table. And I think you're going to see more of that, because I think as writers get older, they become increasingly nostalgic.
Mm-hmm.
They start going back to their roots. You start realizing you have more life behind you than you have ahead of you. And you start living a little bit in the past. Okay.
That's interesting. That's an interesting point. I wonder, there's always the question, and I asked Mary Higgins Clark this recently, what's going to happen when you're not here anymore? Are you going to have somebody writing your books under your name? And would you allow that?
I haven't even thought about that. Okay, I'm not sure they would even approach me on that. I don't know. I don't know.
Do they own your name?
No. I own my name. I own all the characters. So they would have to get my permission to do that.
And it would pass to your daughter if you weren't here.
It would be part of my estate. Yeah.
Right. But I always wonder. You know, it seems like they're doing that. They're going to do that with Robert Parker now. Somebody else is going to write this.
Yeah, dispenser. Parker had a huge following, and he had, like you say, 30 books that were cemented. Okay.
Right.
I have 15 books total. Okay. So I don't think I have.
Yeah, but you got 15 great ones.
Yeah, I appreciate that. And I hope they have a long shelf life. In fact, we're doing a tap dance right now with Putnam, trying to get them to put my backlist in ebook format. Okay. They've agreed to do it, but they won't say when. Okay. And I'm not sure why. Some of them are already out there in ebook format.
Well, wouldn't they want to try to sell them?
Well, sure, they have a compelling duty under the contract to make their best effort to sell them. The problem is it takes money to put things in ebook format, and they have a current list of best-selling authors, okay, who they have to put their books as each one is written. So what they've got is a backlog, and I think every publisher is trying to deal with this, okay? They've
right.
got a backlog of the number of books that are coming out. There's still a mountain of material being written every year, and each one of those has to be digitized, okay? Now, the digitization process for the current books isn't so bad because they're already digitized when they're written on a computer. But many of those old books, you'd have to start the process completely over again, either with a scanning, an optical scanner that has sophistication to be able to do this, or they have to be rekeyed, okay, which is
right.
an undertaking.
Now, can people still get the first, all those books from Putnam? Can they get the books themselves? Are they still in print?
They have to be able to get the paperbacks.
Right.
If you write and you order a paperback and they don't deliver it, oftentimes they'll say it's not available right now, but it's in reprint. Okay.
Well, because I mean, people that are listening now have never.
Books.
Right.
If the books are out of print, technically the rights revert to the author. There's a process, a formality you have to go through to make a demand.
I mean, there are people listening now who probably have never read you, and I would highly suggest they go back and get all of your books, all of your old books, because they're all incredible books, and I hate.
They should be able to order them on Amazon or order them through their local bookstore.
Right.
The bookstore should be able to produce the book, okay? And I suspect they are available in paperback. The hardcovers go out of print fairly quickly, okay? They last maybe a year or two, and after that, the only hardcovers you're going to find are going to be used bookstores, okay? Unless they do a reprint, but that's very rare.
Right.
So it's the paperbacks that you're going to find.
I'm absolutely amazed at your integrity. I mean, you obviously have some integrity. I mean, you're very focused on making a good product, and you really go out of your way to do the best you can possibly do.
I appreciate that.
And that's not every author that does that.
No.
And I'm not trying to single out any authors.
No,
I'm just saying as much as I may respect Nora Roberts, I don't know how you can write four or five books a year and do what she does. I have no idea how she does it.
Yeah.
I'd love to ask her sometimes, but I don't think she's even going to answer the question.
No.
Because it's physically, I don't know how you can do it, right? That many books a year.
I couldn't, but then I'm writing different books than she is. Okay.
But is it all about is a lot of it about quantity? When you have a name, you want to get as many books as you can out.
Well, I think the publisher would like that. I mean, obviously, at one point, I talked to them about that, and I said, you know, just out of curiosity, you know, would you take two books a year from me? And their answer was no, years ago. They said, no, you can oversell the market, okay, with books if you try and force-feed it in that way. So.
But Nora Roberts can.
Well, those are romance novels, okay, basically.
And you think that makes a difference?
Different market for that.
Huh. Okay?
So it's a whole different genre. And it's probably the only genre where that, you know, kind of
I wonder why. I mean,
volume can exist. Right now, I mean, Lee Childs, for example, is a very good writer.
And he's writing two a year now.
Well, I'm not sure he's writing two a year now. What happened was he always kept one banked, okay? He was always a year ahead of them on his deadlines. Very smart move.
Right. Oh, yeah.
And what happened was the publisher found out he had one in the bank, okay, that was already done, and they pushed him to get that book published, and so all of a sudden in 1 year he had two books come out, okay? Whether he'll be able to do that on a consistent basis every year, I doubt.
Well, he's such a great writer, too. I mean, he's...
Yeah, that's the point. He's a good writer. He wants to maintain the quality, and I think he probably will insist on that.
And one heck of a great supporter of other writers. I mean,
yeah.
That's the kind of writer we need around. I mean, just somebody who always is saying nice things about other people too.
And he is, and he and I have a feeling he will not allow the quality of his books to be diminished by the pressure from the publisher to produce more on an annual basis.
Right.
I have a feeling if push comes to shove, you know, he might be able to do it for a year or two, but that's tough. To do that on an ongoing basis every year with the depth and quality of the stories that he writes puts severe pressure on your author. You're killing the goose that laid the golden egg if you do that to someone like that.
Well, this has been a fantastic hour. You've been just wonderful. I do have one more question. What's your biggest fear?
Oh, boy. I'm not sure I have any at this point, okay?
You sound like you're a little neurotic, but aren't all writers neurotic?
Yeah, I think so. I think we're sort of A-type personalities.
I mean, I'm neurotic. I know I'm neurotic, but I'm not even a writer.
Yeah. You know, I don't. There were times when I guess my greatest fear is for the next generation, for my daughter and their that generation, that they should have some of the opportunities in the life that we had, the opportunities that were showered on us.
Right.
And I fear that they won't because of what I see happening. And not just in America, but to the Western world, okay, to the Western nations.
Right.
We've made a lot of mistakes, so it's time to go back and correct some of those. And it may be necessary for our generation to pay some of the freight for that.
Okay? Right.
So it may be the only way we're going to get out of the morass we're in at this point. So
well,
that's the biggest fear.
Right. Well, now that you've hinted that maybe we're not going to see a book of yours next year, now I'm really depressed. I don't know what to do now because...
No, I'm not saying you won't. let me explain to you. I'm on tour right now, and last year at this time, I hadn't started Traders, so...
Oh, okay.
I had my outline done, but I hadn't...
So there's still hope.
I had no title. I had no title. The research was largely incomplete, and so I did all of that after the tour ended.
Well, that's very impressive, because what came out, Trader of Secrets, is a fantastic book, and you know, it couldn't have been easy.
Yeah, so I'll be meeting with my editor, and we'll see how much arm-twisting they do when I get back to New York. And they're somewhat limited at this point, because in the past, what they would do is they'd shower more money on you to try and induce you to do certain things.
Okay? Right.
If you said no, initially, they'd come back and they'd offer you more money. But number one, I was in a different position then. You know, I was much younger and needed the money in some respects for my future.
So you're not even worried they're not going to be interested in you anymore?
Well, no, they've offered me two. They've offered me seven-figure contracts a piece for two books.
Right. Okay.
So I've told them I won't sign contracts right now with you or anybody else, you know, because I'm going to write the next book on the come. And I talked with my editor about that, okay, and he and I have sort of left it open to discuss it when I go back to Thriller Fest in July.
So what does your agent think about all this?
Well, obviously, they want to keep you writing.
Right.
They weren't happy. They weren't particularly happy when I waived the signing money, but I explained that was hard and fast. I wasn't going to move off of it. And I don't like having other people's money in my pocket before I perform.
Very good. That's good for you. I applaud you. I mean, that takes some guts.
Well, it also takes a lot of stress off of you. Okay.
When yes.
It comes to worse and I get sick and can't finish a project, I don't have any of their money I have to worry about paying back. If I drop dead, my estate, my daughter, I never worry about paying back a large signing advance.
Right.
So I didn't want to burden other people with that, and I didn't need the money. So why have it in my pocket if I don't need it? And it creates that kind of stress. It just didn't make any sense to me.
Well, you're one in a million, because I don't think I'll ever hear anybody say that. So. It's been a pleasure to talk to you. We've been gone for a long time, but it's been wonderful. Thank you so much.
All right, very good.
And this is we've been talking about Trader's Secrets by Steve Martini. It's out in all your bookstores from Morrow, a William Morrow company, and it's in hardcover, and it's absolutely terrific, as are all of his books. And this has been David's Book Talk, and we'll talk to you later.